This is the first day of June 2014. And I'd like to read the introduction of a book called From Novice to Master by Soko Morinaga Roshi. The subtitle of the book is An Ongoing Lesson in the Extent of My Own Stupidity. Which grounds this title, From Novice to Master, which is kind of way up there. Strangely enough, I read this book years back and has deep, profound teachings in a very light-hearted way. It's quite interesting. A while ago, I gave a public lecture at the university. The speaker who preceded me talked for about an hour and a half, running over his allotted time. The break period between our talks was shortened, and I was called to the podium right away. Concerned for the audience, I opened by asking, "Did you all have time to urinate?" Apparently, this was not what the audience had expected to hear. Perhaps they were particularly surprised because the person standing before them talking about pissing was a monk. Everyone broke into hearty laughter. Having started out on this note, I continued to drive home the point. Pissing is something that no one else can do for you. Only you can piss for yourself. This really broke them up, and they laughed even harder. But you must realize that to say you have to piss for yourself, nobody else can piss for you, is to make an utterly serious statement. Long ago in China, there was a monk called Ken. During his training years, he practiced in the monastery of Ta Wi. But despite his prodigious efforts, he had not attained enlightenment. One day, Ken's master ordered him to carry a letter to our far-off land of Changsha. This journey, round trip, would easily take half a year. A huge difference from text messaging today, WhatsApp, and other means of communication, where if you don't answer in 5 minutes, they say, "What's the matter?" And here it could, the round trip would easily take half a year. How come the teacher could ask someone to take half a year to deliver one letter? The monk Ken thought, I don't have forever to stay in this hall practicing. Who's got the time to go on an errand like this? He consulted one of his seniors, monk and soul Genhosa, about the matter. Genhosa laughed when he heard Ken's predicament. Even while traveling, you can still practice Zen. In fact, I'll come along with you, he offered. And before long, the two monks set out on their journey. Even while traveling, you can still practice Zen. Even while walking, even while shitting, even while working, you can still practice Zen. Of course, to be quietly in the Zendo is the easiest way to practice, the best way to practice in that sense. But as Sishin demonstrates to all of us, every minute we spend in Sishin, if you can practice Zen all day long elsewhere, in Sishin, which is designed specifically to do Sishin at every moment, why not? One day, while the two were traveling, the younger monk Ken suddenly broke into tears. I have been practicing for many years, and I still haven't been able to attain anything. Now, here I am, roaming around the country on this trip. There's no way I'm going to attain enlightenment this way, he lamented. Here I am roaming around the country on this trip. There's no way I'm going to attain enlightenment. Here I am in this Sishin. Best ideal place to attain enlightenment. And yet, I am distracted. And yet, my pains, my legs hurt. My knees have pain. I am pain. Not my knees. Here I am in Sishin. I get distracted. When he heard this, Genhosa, trusting all the strength he had into his words, put himself at the junior monk's disposal. I will take care of anything that I can take care of you, or for you in this trip, he said. But there are just five things I cannot do in your place. I will take care of anything that I can take care of you or for you. You can concentrate. I can't wear clothes for you. I can't eat for you. I can't shit for you. I can't piss for you. And I can't carry your body around and live your life for you. Sisheen can't do it for you either. The teacher can't either. Here, Gensoha is acting as a teacher. And I can't carry your body around and live your life for you. Of course, it is painful to see someone suffering. It is painful to see someone just snoozing off in Sisheen. It's painful to see someone going to the water table, just staring into the space out the window. Painful to see how we get distracted, take advantage of every moment to our egos, take advantage of every moment in which we bring down the guard of our attention and pounces right back. Did you watch this? Did you hear that? The instructions for Sasen are direct, simple. Following them is another matter. And it is because our egos want us distracted. We give in. What really matters is not how concentrated you are, but that you go back to the practice every time. That's what builds up our concentration. Going back to the practice. It helps you to be in the practice, and it builds up your determination to be in the practice. It is said that upon hearing these words, the monk can suddenly awaken from his deluded dream and attain a great enlightenment, a great satori. I hope that as you read this, you realize that I am not just talking about myself, about something that happened elsewhere. No, it is about your urgent problem that I speak. The first chapter is called The Prospect of My Own Death. I'll just read a couple of phrases and go commenting as we go along. If I were to sum up the past 40 years of my life, the time since I became a monk, I would have to say that it has been an ongoing lesson in the extent of my own stupidity. When I speak of my stupidity, I do not refer to something that is innate. But rather to the false impressions that I have cleverly stockpiled layer upon layer in my imagination. So a lesson in the extent of my own stupidity being these layers, cleverly stockpiled, that describe who you are. And what you can do and not do. How you can be. How you adapt to your circumstances. And it is not innate in you. It's something you have cleverly stockpiled, layer upon layer. And that is stupidity. Whenever I travel, I keep reading, whenever I travel to foreign countries to speak, I am invariably asked to focus on one central issue. Just what is Satori? Just what is enlightenment? This thing called Satori, however, is a state that one can understand only through experience. It cannot be explained or grasps those words through words alone. That's fundamental. Satori, Satori. Enlightenment's enlightenment. Descriptions are mere descriptions, not the true thing. That's why we have to demonstrate our enlightenment in the Dokusan room. To demonstrate it because it cannot be explained. Not even to one, to another one that's had the experience. By way of example, there's a proverb that says, to have a child is to know the heart of a parent. Regardless of how a parent may demonstrate the parental mind to a child, that child cannot completely understand it. Only when children become parents themselves, they fully know the heart of a parent. Such an understanding can be likened to awakening, to enlightenment, although enlightenment is far deeper still. Because no words can truly convey the experience of enlightenment, here I will discuss the essentials for awakening, the essentials of Zen training. Zen training is not a matter of memorizing the wonderful words found in the sutras and in the records of ancient teachers. Rather, these words must serve as an impetus to crush the false notions of one's imagination. The purpose of practice is not to increase knowledge, but to scrape the scales off the eyes, to pull the plugs out of the ears. Through practice, one comes to see reality, and although it is said that no medicine can cure folly, whatever prompts one to realize, I was a fool, is, in fact, just such a medicine. We all have false views about ourselves and others. The beginning of my teaching, sometimes I would find myself seeing that someone had done something that distracted that person or us, not in the right direction. And I would come to conclusions of why that person had done whatever he had done or she had done. I would analyze the action and the person. Then I would ask him, Dokusan, why did you do that? And I found myself always in the wrong. My interpretation was always in the wrong, or most of the times. So I learned the hard way to mention the action. It is best to do this that way, not this way. And not judge the person. That's what we always do. Someone does something, we become defensive. Ah, he's trying to prove me wrong. In my first years of practice, was a waiter in Arnold Park, where the tables were low. Oh, the same tables they have now. They're different, different surface, but had to fit 50 people in there. It was a little tight. And as a waiter, you had to put the plates down exactly where they had to go. And I happened to be working with someone who was extremely fast. He had finished when I was halfway. So with time I became faster as well. Out of a sense of competition. And then, as I got faster, he got faster. Then my mind began to play tricks on me, saying, he's doing it to bother you. He wants you to be a fool. And where I ended being best was to put down the plates at the exact distance between one another, so I didn't have to come back and do it and check them out. And that's where I was faster. So it got me in a kind of a mind state of paranoia, he's after me. He wants to demonstrate I'm useless. It's part of the pile of rubbish that ego creates to distract you. Later on, I learned that this person was hyperactive. And he couldn't go slow. He had to go fast, and that was his problem. He was hoping for me to slow him down. And he was sorry I had gotten so fast, because that wasn't slowing him down. But in Sesshin, you become so sensitive. You invent, you make up stories. About others. Just to protect yourself. Which is a folly. In this, now this place, Shaping Mill, the distance we have between one and another is much larger. It's not so difficult here. And yet there are times where we see other people in the wrong. We have to be careful when we are here, being extremely sensitive. not to misplace judgment of others, because that is just a distraction of our practice. It is how the ego wants us to work. Me against others. Instead of me with others. We have to be careful. Through practice, one comes to see reality. The purpose of practice is not to increase knowledge, but to scrape the scales off the eyes, to pull the plugs out of the ears. Through practice, one comes to see reality. And although it is said that no medicine can cure folly, whatever prompts one to realize I was a fool is, in fact, just such a medicine. It is also said that good medicine is bitter to the taste, and sadly enough, the medicine that makes people aware of their own foolishness certainly is acrid. The realization that one has been stupid seems always to be accompanied by so-called trials and tribulations, by setbacks and sorrows. I spent the first half of my own life writhing under the effects of this bitter medicine. Goes on to describe where he was born and how he was a student at high school. A little strange, he's around 19, he's studying letters. Students of literature, on the other hand, while he was studying in high school, students had been granted formal reprieve from military duty. She was born just in time. The fierce heat of World War II found me studying with the Faculty of Literature under Japan's old system of education in Toyama High School. Students didn't have to go to war until after they were 20. But then they decided that, yes, they had to go to war. They didn't have enough men. So they had to train them and get them out the battlefield. People who entered the army in those days rushed headlong, fervently believing that this was a just war, a war of such significance that they could sacrifice their lives without regret. Setting out in this spirit, we were armed with a provisional solution to the problem of death, or at least this is my case. And so we students set out in planes armed only with the certainty of death and fuel for a one-way trip, with favorite books of philosophy or maybe a book about Buddha's pure land besides a control stick, certain to remain unread. Many lunged headlong at enemy ships. Still many others were felled by the crest of a wave or knocked down from the air before making that lunge. Then on August 15, 1945, came Japan's unconditional surrender. The war that everyone had led to believe was so right, the war for which we would gladly lay down our own life, was instead revealed overnight as a war of aggression, a war of evil, and all those responsible for it were to be executed. And for better or for worse, I returned from the army alive. It must be quite shocking to find out that everything in which you believed suddenly is untrue. Everything just simply looks the outlook must be shattering to your egos. He's back from the war, goes to study, but students don't want to study, they want to argue. And they ask teachers not to come in because they have important arguments in the classroom. Until a teacher convinces them that the best thing they can do is finish their studies. He found that the land his family had owned, he lost his parents during the war. His three sisters were living far away. The taxes took away the money he had. And the land was taken up by the government and given to other people. So she would just hang around every day. Wondering if he should commit suicide by hurling my body onto a railroad track. I woke up miserable every morning, and every day was as good as lost. Falling asleep in the worst of spirits, I would awaken to a new morning even darker. This vicious circle continued day after day, but somehow I managed to graduate from high school. However, I had absolutely no inclination to enroll in university or to study anything at all. I went on to pass the days idly slouching around. Then in the midst of that intense mental agony, I finally struck upon a realization. For as long as I could remember, I had done nothing but read books, acquire knowledge, churn up theories. The reason that I was now as a total loss for what to do with myself was, in the end, I had never really used this body of mine, in any kind of disciplined way. Now this part of use your body in a disciplined way. That your mind in any disciplined way. So it was through these mysterious causes and conditions that I was led to knock at the gates of Zen temples. I still feel very grateful that after calling at 2 or 3 temples, was brought to Daishuin in Kyoto, where I still reside, to train under Suigan Goto Roshi. Suigan Roshi, formerly the abbot of Myosinji, at that time the abbot of Daitokuji, was a truly great man. I showed up at Roshi's door with a long stringy hair and kept with a towel hanging from my waist and heavy clogs on my feet. This great man's first words to me were, "Why have you come here?" In reply, I rambled for about an hour and a half, covering the particulars of my situation up to and including my present state. Roshi listened in silence, not attempting to insert so much as a single word. Yeah, I can just hear him faulting the world for everything that had happened to him. When I had finished my exposition, he spoke. Listening to you now, I can see that you reached a point where there's nothing you can believe in. There is no such thing as practice without believing in your teacher. Can you believe in me? I've never seen that so clearly put. There's not such thing as practice without believing in your teacher. Can you believe in me? Though he's singing about the relation teacher, student, this and that. But here after this long explanation, do you believe in me? Can you believe in me? If you can, I'll take you wrong right now, as you are. But if you can't believe in me, then your being here is just a waste of time. And you can go right on back where you came from. Suigan Roshi, for his part, set forth in no uncertain terms from the very beginning the precept of believing wholeheartedly in one's teacher. But I was not sensible enough at that time to yield with a ready and honest, "Okay. Yes." Roshi was then 70 years old, and I told myself, "This foolish old man. So what if he's the head of Myosinji or the head of Daikokuji? Lots of important people in this world aren't worth much. If believing were so easy that I could just believe unconditionally in somebody I had just met for the first time, then wouldn't I have believed in something before I even showed up here? Didn't I come here in the first place because I didn't find it so easy to believe?" All this ran through my mind, but I knew from the start that if I said it aloud, I would be told straight away, "In that case, your being here is a waste of time. Go on home now." Fearing that, even if my words were a lie, this man would have to let me stay if I spoke them, I said, "I believe in you, please." At that time, I had no idea of the weight of those words, "I believe." But this was a lesson I was to be taught before the end of that very day. Let's just see what he was taught that very day. "Follow me," directed the Roshi, and he assigned me the first task, which was to clean the garden. Together with his 70-year-old Roshi, I went out to the garden and started sweeping with a bamboo broom. The human being, or my own mind, I should say, is really quite mean. Here I was, inside my heart, denouncing this old fool and balking at the very idea of trusting so easily. Yet at the same time, I wanted this old man to notice me, and so I took up the broom and swept with a vengeance. Quite soon I had amazed a mountain of dead leaves. Eager to show off my diligence, I asked, "Roshi, where should I throw this trash?" The words were barely out of my mouth when he thundered back at me, "There is no trash. There is no trash. No trash, but look here." I tried to indicate the pile of leaves. "So you don't believe me, is that it?" "It's only that, well, where should I throw all these leaves?" That was all that was left for me to say. "You don't throw them out," he roared again. "What should I do then?" I asked. "Go out to his shed and bring back an empty charcoal sack," he had instructed. He was his instruction. And I read aloud. Sometimes I'm a little dyslexic, so change words around. So please, just bear it in mind if I do that. When I returned, I found Roshi bent to the task of combing through the mountain of leaves, sifting, so that the lighter leaves came out on top, while the heavier sand and stones fell to the bottom. Then proceeded to stuff the leaves into the sack that I had brought from the shed, tamping them down with his feet. After he had jammed the last leaves tightly into the sack, he said, "Take these to the shed. We'll use them to make a fire under the bath." As I went off to the shed, I silently admired that this sack of leaves over my shoulder was perhaps not trash. I also told myself that what was left on that pile out there in the garden was clearly trash, and nothing but trash. I got back, though, only to find Roshi squatting over the remains of the leaf pile, picking out the stones. After he had carefully picked out the last stone, he ordered, "Take this out and arrange them under the rain gutters." When I had set out the stones together with the gravel that was already there and filled in the spaces pummeled out by the raindrops, I found that not only were the holes filled, but that my work looked rather elegant. I had to allow that these stones, too, failed to fall into the category of trash. But still more, though, the clouds of earth and scraps of moth, the last dregs. Just what could anyone possibly do with that stuff, I wondered. I saw Roshi going about his business, gathering up these scraps and placing them piece by piece in the palm of his hand. He scanned the ground for dents and sinks. He filled them in with the clouds of earth, which he then tamped down with his feet. Not a single particle remained of the mountain of leaves. "Well," he queried, "do you understand a little better now? Do you understand a little bit better now? From the first, in people as in all things, there's not such thing as garbage, as trash." (Clears throat) in people and in things. He didn't see in people that he was referring to him. Not such thing as trash. It was the first sermon I ever heard from Suikan Roshi. That did make an impression on me. Unfortunately, I was not keen enough to attain Satori as a result of simply hearing these words. From the first, in people as in things, there is not such thing as trash. These words point out to the fundamental truth of Buddhism, a truth I could not yet conceive in those days. Wonder of wonders. Intrinsically, all living beings are Buddhas, endowed with wisdom and virtue. Only because they cling to their delusive thinking, they fail to realize this. That's Buddha speaking. Shakyamuni Buddha speaking. Wonder of wonders. To put it in other words, all beings are, from the first, absolutely perfect. But because people are attached to deluded notions, they cannot perceive this innate Buddha nature. How about each one of us? Our delighted ideas, is what does not let us see that we are perfect from the very beginning. That we have this Buddha nature from the very beginning. Our deluded ideas about ourselves and the world. In the classic Chinese sutras, it is written that Shakyamuni said, I attain Buddhahood together with all the grasses, the trees, and the great earth. How is that? How is that that when he became enlightened, Shakyamuni, everything became enlightened, the great earth became enlightened, the trees, the grasses, everything. In a split second, the mist before his eyes cleared, and Shakyamuni Buddha could see the true form of reality. Up to now, I thought all beings in this world were living only in pain and misery. That's Shakyamuni speaking. Up to now, I thought all beings in this world were living only in pain and misery. In deep unhappiness. But in reality, aren't all beings just as they are, living in Buddhahood, living in a state of absolute perfection? Doesn't this apply not only to those who are already and sound of body, who are healthy and sound of body, but also to those who are blind, to those without hands, the ones who are barely dragging themselves along? Isn't each and every one just exactly as he or she presently is, a perfect and flawless being? Awed and astonished, the Buddha called out in the voice of Satori. aren't we all perfect and flawless beings, despite our thoughts, despite our uneasiness? But why don't we know it? Because we believe the layers upon layers that we have built through the years of ideas about ourselves. We believe that is the truth. That's what we are. And that's why we can't awaken to our true nature. That's where Sesshin, being here, takes place. We don't know what it feels to be, we don't know how it feels, we don't know the mind state, we don't know what it is to not believe in our own descriptions of what and who we are. We don't know. That's why it's so difficult. We know it's easy if they tell you, go from here to Rochester, or go from here to Mexico, go from here to London. You know how to do it. But here, the instruction is clear. But we don't know how it is. So it's extremely difficult. And that's why it takes such an effort. Because we have to suspend, we have to allow an instant in which there is no I, and where Buddha nature can just shoot out and come forward and say, yes, here I am, Buddha. Just an instant. But we need to muster energy. We need to accumulate concentration. We need to really just pour ourselves into the practice, to allow that instant, that crack of our beams. We have to align the mind, the emotions, the body, have to be aligned in that second, split second, which true nature can just burst out. And it can be done. Thousands before me, thousands after me will do it. And each one of us can do it, and do it again and again to deepen the practice. Deepen the awakening. Not just once, but many times. Oh, hold on tight for the ride. Just concentrate. On your practice. Stop here and have the four vowels.